When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
No Jumper, coolest podcast in the world, and today I am in here with the one and only Evidence. How you feeling, man?
Doing great, you?
Excellent, man. I'm sorry I made you wait around a little while because we had some complications with the previous interviews, but very, very excited to have you in here.
I got to know Laura.
You really did get to know my publicist, probably better than I know her.
She asked me every question. I literally, at one point, I said, I'm just going to stop talking to you.
So you're just sick of talking about yourself at this point because mm-hmm. of the publicist rapport that you were going through before?
We stood in front of a gold wall and talked about France. It was fire.
That's what Melrose is all about, is just standing in front of different walls and making people take photos of you.
And we saw people doing Instagram photos just for the gram.
A lot of that around here.
Good shit.
A lot of walls that really are not there for the structural integrity of the wall are really just there to be photographed in front of, which is kind of the world we live in now.
I was going to say, in Melrose's defense, that's nothing new. It's just Instagram.
Yeah.
Melrose always had that. All these alleys back here were always... shit growing up right here.
Give me some early memories of Melrose. I know you're a Venice kid, but yeah, you probably were coming out here, right?
Hip-hop shop on did you hear about that ever?
No, I heard you talk about it on Talib's interview,
on
I think.
So it was just a spot. This dude Hex owned it, and they sold fat caps for graffiti. They sold fat laces. They sold graffiti mag shirts. Con Art was the popping shit at that time. I don't know if you know that label. I think a lot of graffiti crews would meet up there because the location is central to the east side, to the west side. It's kind of like a middle ground for everybody. So
Right. You
would just run into the ill cats. And then that's where I met Rocco and how we formed Dilated was rapping in there.
So you primarily, were you interested in graffiti before rapping? Because graffiti is like very accessible. You don't need anything when you're a youngin' and you get interested in writing. It's like you don't need any connects. Whereas in rap, there's a whole lot of equipment you don't need and shit.
Yeah, I was good at baseball. That was my thing. I was a pitcher.
Okay.
And I had the ill curveball. Nobody could fuck with it. And it got so addictive, I would just throw that over and over and just strike everybody out. As soon as I throw straight, they killed it. You know what I mean? So it was like this addiction. But I think a lot of kids know, like, you're not supposed to throw curves when your body's still developing because it's like snapping their arm and it's fucking with your elbow.
Really? I didn't know that. That makes sense.
So like most kids who are pitchers, they encourage them to just throw changeups or fastballs. That's it.
Okay.
And I just got addicted to this. And my coach told me, if you do it right, you'll be all right. You know what I mean?
Was he stupid?
Yes. and so I, fifth grade, sixth grade, eighth grade, after every game, I'm sitting with my arm, I'm trying to write in school the next day, I'm shaking, you know what I mean? It was bad, but it was an addiction. I couldn't not throw it, you know? And so eventually I got to high school, and the distance between the mound went to major league distance. So from the pitcher to the catcher was 60 feet now instead of 45.
Right.
The base pass were 90 instead of 60. And I started throwing that curve, and it was just hanging too long, and I wasn't big enough yet. And fools just started killing that shit. And they were hitting me. So I started like losing my love for baseball because I stopped being good at it.
Right.
Or I was in a transitional period, maybe if I had written it out. But I found graffiti right there. You know what I mean?
As a kid, you were one of those kids who was like super obsessed with the sport and just couldn't imagine it doing anything else with your life?
No, I mean, I had regular kid activities. I wasn't, at that time, you can do mad shit when you're young. You can juggle, whatever. You know what I mean? I was still into girls. I was still into whatever I was into, but baseball was just something I knew that I was good at. It was game time, I was ready to go. You know what I mean? And so when I stopped doing good, I found graffiti, took acid and went to Venice Beach. You know what I mean? Like my whole shit changed because I just opened up another side of my mind. I guess previous to that, I was never like a creative per se.
But did you decide to do the acid at that moment because you sort of knew that you were at the transitionary moment in your life?
I grew up in Venice Beach, so I think, that, I mean, doses, people used to offer those to us when we were skating, when we were young.
Right.
We just knew, no, we're not doing acid. You know what I mean? But as you get older and you see it enough, friends are doing it, do that. You know what I mean? I think it was normal to be in Venice and doing it. I think times are different. If my son told me he's three, but God forbid at 11 or 12, he told me he's doing acid, I'm going to freak out. You know what I mean? But for me at the time, it felt like what you're supposed to do.
You think about that a lot, how your kid, if he lived the life that you lived as a young man, that you'd be extremely upset, and the unsurmountable challenge that you have in keeping a kid away from bad elements when they're young?
No, I'm not tripping on that yet.
No?
Not yet.
Well, three.
Yeah, I've got a minute before I got to worry.
Three is like, I got a three-year-old nephew. It's all Pokemon and dinosaurs.
That's what I'm saying. I got him Dragon Ball Z early, you know?
Yeah.
That's about it.
Dragon Ball Z even be a little advanced for my nephews. Yeah, but man, Venice must have been a wild ass place to grow up. And I sit. Sorry.
Yeah.
I say that just as somebody who, you know, spent a lot of time just going to the beach or hitting up the skate park or just sort of riding around and stuff.
Are you from LA?
No, I'm from like right outside Boston.
Oh shit.
But I've been out here for like 10 years, and I was in Long Beach for the first like 3-4 years. So it's, you know, kinda it's like an interesting place to get a hang of later on, you know, in your life. Like Venice is just, it's a beach town, but it's got like a way seedier element than most beach towns.
And it's changed a lot. A lot of people hear me talking about Venice and they think of a rich place, you know, but
tech startups and shit.
Yeah, yeah. It's really got like you're in a mansion or you're homeless. You know what I mean? It's yeah. that middle thing is like a target on your house. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's a trip.
So growing up, there was no gentrification yet.
Not yet. No. I think it was like the last ghetto at the beach, true ghetto at the beach, you know, uh-huh. And it bred a certain kind of person. All the skaters I knew were crazy. You know, they're fighting, you know, surfers, the same thing.
That's when I think of Venice, I think of wild ass skaters. Like most skaters are pretty chill and most communities, I feel like Venice is definitely a place where you could get beat up at the skate park.
100%. And then the gang element was mixed right in the middle of it. There was a lot
Mexican
of
gangs,
Mexican gangs and black gangs and black on brown crime, you know, I mean, as far as like gang rivalries and stuff like that. So like you could easily I could be walking down the street and get caught up in it just by the way I look, you know what I mean? Or right. Something like that. It was a place you definitely knew, had to know how to navigate through. And it just made you keep your guard up, and it made you a certain kind of person, different than a lot of other places in LA.
Right.
And they have their stories as well, you know.
It's interesting because it seems like, you know, there's like a certain type of white dude that can vibe or fit in as a rapper in the rap game. And it's like with you, even way back when I first started to know about Dilated, it was like you rarely heard that conversation even much about like, yeah, you know, it's like white guy in a group and shit. It was just almost like glossed over, where I was like with Eminem, that was like the whole conversation for a while.
Yeah. I'm racially ambiguous.
You kind of are. Yeah.
You know, in France, I'm French, and in Italian and Italy. So yeah, it's I blend in well.
Right.
Yeah.
What was your early memories of hip hop and that endeared you to it even before you got super close to the culture?
The early memories I have are Venice Beach. I mean, Santa Monica Pier first, actually.
Mm.
People break dancing, just going down there to ride bumper cars and then seeing a circle happening, people dancing, not knowing what that was. Finding out the song that they were playing, making my mom buy me that song, playing that shit over and over and over.
Any songs stand out that were
jam
elementary
on it,
school?
Jam on it, Nucleus. That was the one that I just couldn't get over.
But we're talking early. What year are we talking?
I'm probably like 5 years old. You know what I mean? So like
shit,
like
okay.
Mid 80s. You know what I mean? Early 80s.
For me, it was like Snoop was like the first thing
I
saw that
so
I really gravitated toward. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. By Snoop, by the time Snoop happened, I was knowing what rap was, how it was getting made around people who were coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in terms of like hot spots that you were sort of, did you just sort of figure out at some point like, oh, Melrose is like one of the places where there's actually like some culture at and I can be around?
I think it was just like around 15, a lot of my homies like a year older started getting a car.
Mm.
You know, you want to go somewhere.
That's when everything starts changing. Yeah, all of a sudden, you can go places.
Places or sneak out and go places. So Melrose was just the thing. Graffiti was popping on Melrose. So, and there was probably a lot of people you would bump into that you knew through passing or whatever, pre-internet shit.
I heard it was like wall-to-wall people out here too, that it was like way more people on the street than you could ever imagine at that time.
Yeah, the memories of it were, it was a little more hood. It's still like, you know, you could get caught up out here, but it's tourists mostly. You know, I think Fairfax was popping. That was bleeding into the streets.
Yeah. there's some opportunistic people who come through and just will sort of live off of Melrose. Like, my, one of my favorite things ever was I saw, and it's fucked up, but it was funny as fuck. I seen these three kids walk by with Supreme bags, these three little dorky ass white kids. And then they walk by again, like 10 minutes later, coming from the other direction. And they're like, you know, some guy walked up to us and asked us to see our bags, and he ran off with all of them. I'm like,
we just got jacked on Fairfax not too long ago.
Who did?
Me and a couple of homies, man. We had our, I'll leave their names out, but yeah, we parked. We saw some homies we knew on the street. We got right out. I guess for some reason we didn't lock the car. Laptop got stolen, all this shit. There's a camera showing the guy doing it, but we don't know. He's gone.
Right.
He got that. He got that. So it's just crazy.
So you came here like to get into the graffiti thing sort of, and then you just ended up sort of gravitating more towards the music side of things. What was it? Were you not terribly talented as a graffiti artist?
I was pretty good. There were some guys who were incredible. I was all right. I think when you're that age, things are hobbies more. You know, there's like, you're more, it's easier to jump in and jump out of something.
Yeah, you haven't started thinking about making a living or anything
that,
yet.
And your identity's not fully formed, so you're just trying things out to see where you go. So like baseball was one, graffiti was another. Skateboarding was another. Uh-huh. But when rapping happened, that was it. There was nothing. I hadn't felt the feeling of that. That was the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just knew that had to be it.
Yeah, and I came up around a lot of talented people who were, like, killing shit. So some people, it seems like a million miles away, the idea of actually making success is, like, way over there. But when you see your people who are doing it from the beginning and you see the potential of what it could be, and that's just your introduction to it. So this is your normal.
Yeah.
Doing a big ass show for thousands of people, that's what you're supposed to be doing, you know? And so right. The bar got set real high, like early. I just surrounded myself around greats. Even when I was just trying to figure this shit out, I always fronted somehow or always figured out a way to get in with those people and, you know, feel that energy and try to apply it as much as possible. So yeah, like scaring yourself and hanging out with people who are better than you at shit as you get older becomes more difficult because you're more stuck in your ways, your ego's formed.
Yeah.
But when you're that young, you just like, it's like it's just the most attractive shit.
Did you say you were a jiu-jitsu guy?
Yeah, I've been doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, that I remember having that feeling to a real extreme, like when I first started trying to do jiu-jitsu, like taking classes and stuff, and I didn't know what it was. And then I sort of realized, like, oh, you only primarily do things that you're real good at in your day-to-day life, and now here you are and you're a white belt and you're struggling in these classes. And I just like realized that and a lot of that weight was sort of alleviated when I had that realization. But it's like, oh, this is what it is to put yourself into an environment where you don't know anything and you're a total beginner. And it's a very unique space to put your brain into.
For sure, man. It's the most humbling shit. And then imagine being a blue belt and then you feel like you've got somewhere and then a white belt taps you out.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It gets more and more crazy as you start progressing into it. So yeah, that's the most humble shit, to walk into a jiu-jitsu spot and just be like, yo, what the fuck? Because these dudes are like, you're like a little fucking baby to them. Uh-huh. Like when I play with my son and I move around and do that, that's how like I am to them. So the humility of that, just knowing like how much up some people are on you in the street, and you wouldn't even know it because they're just like skinny built, you know what I mean? They're not, and they walk around polite. You could start something with the wrong person and be completely fucked.
Definitely.
That shit is crazy.
I remember talking to my first instructor, and he told me he had been doing security in Huntington Beach for like 10, 15 years. And I'm like, damn, you had to beat the fuck out of anybody anytime? She's like, honestly, I never threw a punch. He's just like, kind of grabbed my hand and like tugged it behind my back a little bit, and I was like, oh, and he's like, yeah, he's like, you know, I'll just walk him out real aggressive.
I'm light on it now though, man.
Really?
Yeah, I've been light.
It's been, well, it's just hard to keep up the lifestyle, injuries,
yeah,
schedule.
I got my son. I've had a crazy couple years right now, like 3-4 years where it's been hard to focus on that alone. So yeah, just finding time for jiu-jitsu right now is taking a back seat, but
definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
So I got familiar with Dilated, I guess, like maybe 2003, 2004, when I was like fresh out of college and shit. When did the group actually first form, though?
We put out singles in 98 and 99.
For real?
Yeah.
Holy shit, okay.
Just on 12-inch at Fat Beats.
Right.
And then we got our deal in 2000 on Capitol.
Uh-huh.
And then we did four albums.
Right. And so
I think 2004 was our third album. That was the one we were doing. We had a single with Kanye and all that type of stuff.
And that's when all of a sudden, because, you know, I was kind of green. I wasn't like really like too up on the underground shit. I was pretty much like G-Unit and Dipset.
Yeah.
It's like all I knew at that time, or at least all I was really like focused on. But so, okay, like you guys get, what was your career like prior to getting signed? Were you just like the local like LA fucking hip hop crew that was just sort of doing it? Or?
Yeah, Rocka, my partner, he knew DJ Lethal from House of Pain. They went to high school together.
Okay.
So at first we had a demo. We made a demo and with QD3, who's Quincy Jones' son, who's my next door neighbor.
Right.
It's crazy.
And I just heard that story on Celeb Shit. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I got into rap, is through him. And through that, we met Lethal. We got a deal. Album got shelved. And then resurfaced through Independence back when I said. Prior to that, I wouldn't say we were like going around killing shows and like we had this huge buzz when we first started. That happened when we dropped our independent 12 inches.
Right.
Prior to that, we were kind of like just figuring it out. Where we stood in the industry was uncertain at that point, but we knew we were signed to a platinum group, House of Pain, you know, and Alchemist and Scott were signed to Cypress Hill. You know what I mean? It was like, we're in the right place to be. It just wasn't our time yet, but we had like Redman on our album and Exhibit. And we had, it was an all right album. I listened to it and cringed, but the internet seems to like it.
Why are you listening to it and cringe?
Because I didn't know what I was doing yet. There was something in me that people saw for sure that made me get to that point. But at that point I was just emulating. I had no identity, and I was fair weather, meaning whatever I was liking is what I sounded like. So I didn't really come into my own shit till way later, and still evolving today. But that time, it was like, you know, we were kind of trying to go the industry route, really. Like, get a demo, get a deal, come out and let the world discover us through another group that already had success. Be like something they show you, you know? And I'm glad it didn't work out, because we weren't ready. But when we came back out in 2000, we were more ready. And even to that music, I look back and it's hard for me sometimes, but I love the confidence in that music. Like, even when I said a line that didn't age well, I loved how much at the time I thought that line was the shit.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so like that young confidence and determination bleeded through into success. Like, we, as Dilated, we did good. We weren't like pop, but we sold enough records to keep getting the next deal and recouping and et cetera. So it was like, we were definitely onto something. And then, yeah, the rest is to be told as far as going solo and what happened after that.
Right. But
that Kanye time right there was like first time we were ever on 106 in Park, or like doing a Funkmaster Flex thing or things like that, that we had never reached that level of the industry before. That was the song that like put us to that. But in hindsight, that song did more for him than it did for us. You know what I mean? It's still not our biggest record. The single on the album before Worst Come to Worst is still our biggest record.
That was definitely the first song I ever heard. That isn't that weird how one hook like that could just become, I mean, the whole song is great and everything, but the hook just stands out to me to a ridiculous level that is just almost like a career defining sample for the hook there.
Yeah, that shit was crazy. It's not even really a hook. It's funny, just we're scratching a Mobb Deep line over and over, you know. And but that was like the power of like doing it out of format like that. Our label didn't want to make that a single. It was 2.5 minutes. And there was no definitive hook, but the thing kept coming back over and over. So we were telling them this is catchy. And eventually it worked. But the hip hop climate at that time was different. What a hit was undefined. Like, there were no two real hits that sounded the same. There were rap hits, but they were all unique and happened. I wouldn't say they weren't an accident, but there wasn't a real like pattern of a format to go to make a hit record. Right now, a hit record is much more defined, as you can hear it when the beat drops, sometimes before even any vocals, whatever, you know. This is pretty much,
especially like modern pop music, when you hear it just sounds so crazy.
And rap is pop, so there's like it's been stepped on, you know what I mean? And I don't mean that in a bad way, because I'm a music producer, so I love to understand, you know what I mean? But it's definitely much more of a, you could find out what a hit is and do something similar and have a better chance. Whereas then I think people had bars, and then they tried to figure out something catchy to do in between those bars. You know what I mean? And if it worked, then you won. And if it didn't, I got to think back to like what the first like record that sound like maybe Nelly, like Country Grammar was maybe like the first record I heard, like
shocking,
like, oh, this is a hit, you know what I mean, whether I liked it or not, like this is a definitive hit, you know, and like sounded like one. Whereas before, I mean, we could, you know, hits were weird. Mobb Deep had hits, you know what I mean, making music that they just make, you know. And yeah, so the climate of the industry was a little different for us at that time. I don't know where I took a left, but
you spend a lot of time with Everlast?
I do. Not lately so much.
Not lately, but I mean, I'm talking back like early on when you're getting signed and shit, because that must have been a wild ride watching that whole thing happen.
Yeah, we didn't chill with him that much. He was in his prime, living his moment right there.
Right, so around that time that you guys were coming out, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, we were signed to his DJ, Lethal, so who we went on to do Limp Bizkit after.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, we were more like, we were around him. I did a song with them back in the day, but it was still like, I was still like in awe of people who were stars, you know what I mean? So
definitely. Okay, but what were we talking about? That time period of just like when you guys were coming out. Yeah, that was, I mean, yeah, those songs, like that one in particular didn't sound like a super obvious attempt at a hit or anything, but did your mentality start to get a little bit closer to that just because of the pressures from the label? Did you start to sort of change up like the way that you were?
Yeah, that's why we made the Kanye record.
Oh, yeah, but they sort of forced that upon you and told you to get in the studio with him?
Definitely.
But that was him when he was still basically just known as a producer.
Yeah, that's the thing. He was just a dope beat maker. He'd done Jay-Z tracks. He did Beanie Siegel tracks. He did a lot of like things that I liked, that I felt were like-minded to what Alchemist was doing or other people were doing around me. So when they said, you know, we want you to go back and make a hit, or make your album is not turned in, there's no single here, and we chose him in the attempt of just making something that's what we felt. But they had been around him, so they knew his mind had already shifted to, I'm gonna be a big fucking artist.
Right.
Just, I hadn't got the memo yet, but the people at the label knew that shit. And that's why they put us in the room with him. And to their defense, they were very right. You know, he was like something I hadn't seen before.
Really?
Yeah.
He brought a lot to the table.
He just had a real possessed energy.
How'd you meet Alchemist? How early was that?
Alchemist was probably 7th or 8th grade.
Wow.
He was in a graffiti crew I knew that kind of hung out at a certain place on the weekends, maybe like a mall or something like that. So I would see him in passing, and then going out to little clubs back then. I was trying to rap. I think he saw me grab a mic one night, something, and we hooked up, you know, get your number shit.
Yeah.
I think I could still remember his phone number. But yeah, no, him and Scott Conn and those dudes became some of my best friends.
Right.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
And he was an Alchemist yet. He was still Mudfoot. Wow. That was his name. And he was an ill rapper. You know, people need to know. I was like kind of the best in my circle. He had something that was real unique in his rap style.
But I remember when he had like tracks out like not that long ago, right?
No, he still raps.
Yeah,
but I'm saying he was the illest then is what I mean.
Oh, really?
Okay. I'm not dissing him now.
Okay, but I haven't heard a rap in a while.
We have a group together, Step Brothers. He amazes me every time he touches the mic. But back then there was something that was like, it was kind of like he was really, really onto something. And I think after their deal went sour, something happened where he kind of just gave that up and just focused on making the beats. But it's important to know that he could have been like somebody we talk about. It's crazy.
Right.
Yeah. And that's why it's ill when you work with him, because it's one thing if you work with like a rock producer and he's telling the band to do mad shit and they're like, show me what you want. Then show me what the fuck you're talking about. And he grabs the guitar and is like, even if he doesn't play it as good, he's like, I'm talking about this.
Yeah.
Then they're going to go back in and respect him more when he makes his next critique. But Al, you got to keep that in mind. It's like he could really rap. So if he's telling you something while he's producing, it's not coming from a place of ignorance. It's like, I could probably get on the mic and do that, you know, the right way and show you.
Right.
So yeah. Just another level of respect for him.
How do you feel like your style has developed and what like the current evolution of your style is? Because I feel like when we do hear your flow, it feels like you've kind of been focused around like a sort of, like when you talk about how you used to be like influenced by a lot of other people and stuff, whoever you were listening to would sort of rub off on you. We get the feeling when you listen to your raps now, or even to an extent back then, that it's like almost you're like rapping inside of your own world. Like you don't sound terribly influenced by almost anything else that we really hear in the mainstream for sure, but even in the underground, the current rap climate, like where, how do you feel like your style has changed and what are the things that affect that?
I think I think the main thing was just stop trying to be somebody I'm not. That was the first thing. And that was like a big step for me. I said it on that other interview, if you saw it or not, but, mm-hmm. you know, my mom passed away and I tried to make a song for her and put it on the Dilated record, and it just felt weird. And so that told me at that point, I'm not connected enough as an artist to people. I can't even truly say something that I need to say and have my outlet without it coming off as a sore thumb. And so I was like, I need to do solo records for a minute. So when I started doing that, it was a big step out. In my group, Raka has always been known as the spitter, and I've been known as whatever else I've been known for. I think the power of me has always been in my words more than the all the way in the delivery. Like, I've had moments where I've really cut through sharp, but then there's other times where I'm like, I'm gonna sacrifice these syllables right now to really get the point across. And or I might even take words out and leave something so I really can enforce like what I need to say right now. And I think that's, I stopped caring so much about what others thought about me and started getting rewarded for that at shows. More people showing up, more people seeming to be like having a gravitation towards what I'm putting out now versus the other stuff where I was trying to show people that I was trying to be a good rapper. And you know, I'm signed to Rhymesayers, which is Atmosphere and Brother Ali, Aesop Rock, and a lot of people who are super sick, but also known for being super sick live. So going out touring with them for a lot of years definitely like opened me up and made me connect in a different way. And you know, I mean, when I tried, we used to really want a girl and I would go at her crazy, she would never fuck with me. And then the second I stopped caring, she started to want to go out with me for some reason.
Well, that's like kind of a good metaphor for how you rap or whatever is that you sort of, the appeal is in that you're not going as crazy on a song as you could. It was interesting to hear Talib talk about how he kind of picked that up from you, because I mean, he is sort of a quintessential like over rapper. Like a lot of people who say that about Eminem, people would say that about him, that it's like there's certain people who are trying to get such a complex idea across that, or I guess with M, it's the actual words that he's bringing together. With Talib, it's like there's something he's trying to say that a lot of times he's not going to be able to necessarily get out in a simple way, right?
Your mother never, she was always like, I'm going to say this one time and I'm going to say it real fucking slow so you remember it, right? She never was like, go take out the trash real fast for me. You know, I mean, it wasn't, you know, to say something slow and not be able to hide behind anything and just be dog nuts naked when you're rapping is like a skill in itself. You got to understand, it's like, you're not hiding behind tricks. There's no time for filler. It's like a setup and a punch.
Yeah.
So if it's not that shit, you're gonna know that like way obvious, you know? And if it is, it's gonna connect. So that style of rhyming to me is way appealing. I could technically rhyme faster if I needed to, but I feel like that's what's putting me from A to B where I need to be right now.
But that's what's interesting. You're like a hip hop classicist for the most part. But then when you look at a lot of like the usual opinions of sort of people who are like hip hop classics driven type people is that they sort of look down on like Southern rap because it's slow and simple, and they'll like really praise, you know, you constantly still see people discuss hip hop in that super, super simplistic way of like, oh, he's lyrical, he's technical, and he sucks because he's simple. And there's, that's just kind of a,
there's a skill set to all of it, man. Like understanding the rhythm of the beat and becoming an instrument is the reason people are having success right now. You know, melody is everything. Simplicity is everything. So I don't knock somebody because they're not as lyrical. I love songs. You know what I'm saying? I think there's a time to be lyrical. I think that's on Sway. I think that's on Funkmaster Flex. That's when somebody calls you out in a battle. That's for that time in your show where the DJ just drops a beat and you go crazy for a minute. There's a lot of them, but if you're carrying over like me trying to show you how good I am in the process of making songs, you're in the wrong room. You know, there's a time for that. And some people, the great ones, do it coincidentally. Those are the ones that are just ill. When, big pun, certain people I could talk about, like where they were really going the fuck in, but still making a great, like relatable line and something you could fuck with is a real crazy skill set. And a lot of new motherfuckers got that. And it's no secret that that's why they're having success.
Is there anything defeating about mumble rap or SoundCloud rap? Anything that just sort of sticks out to you as like non-hip hop?
No, it's evolution right now. It's what it is. If anything, what I'm doing is alternative now, you know, which is a trip, but it makes sense because industry is over here. There was a time the industry was signing this type of rap. It's not now. They figured out that those hits were too far and few in between. We know how to make those now, and there's artists who do it well. So that's where it's at right now. That's what's popping. If I play some young kid my boom bap beat, it's gonna sound like an era. You know what I mean? And so I respect what people are doing. The truth is, I'm not all the way tuned into it. I listen to the radio a little bit. I don't go out that much. When I do, I try to, you know, figure out what's popping. But for the most part, it really has to like hit me from an angle to jump into something new.
Yeah.
Do you fuck with new shit? Like, I know this is your world and you cover it, but like when you get in your car on the way home, that's what goes in there?
I mean, that's an interesting question, because I feel like the podcast sort of like got where it was because of just the fact that I had so much like sheer excitement about a lot of like new young artists. But then when I think about, I listen to a lot of like, you know, Young Thug's probably my favorite rapper. I'm interested in people who are doing just different things sonically, different things flow wise, different types of beats, different types of ideas. To me, Young Thug's like the most unpredictable rapper I've probably ever listened to, which is why I can still like be excited for his shit after 10 years, which is tough to stay interested in somebody for so long. But I definitely, you know, I'm just interested. You know, I look at somebody like TJX6, who I would assume you probably ain't heard yet, but like the most bizarre, aggressive flow I ever heard. And then like the subject matter of talking about a lot of stuff like scamming shit that I haven't really heard discussed in that way, where he's just being ridiculously detailed with like his criminal tales. You know, I guess I'm just like excited for stylistic innovation is kind of the thing that sort of drives me. Like, I feel like a lot of people just get off on just listening to the same rap that they listened to in high school over and over and over, and that doesn't really do it to me. To me, listening to the same song over and over is almost like reading the same book over and over.
I was on that for a long time. I listened to my classics. At some point, I don't know when, they started to become repetitious to me at some point, and I stopped doing that. But now there's a lot of shit out that's maybe not out to everybody, but is being made today that is innovative, fire, and not fit in the mold as well. And like-minded to what I grew up on, and not in a throwback way either, just taste-wise. You know, it's like you were showing me that kid earlier who was rapping, and the beat came on, and before he started rapping, I already made an opinion about him just on the beat he chose. So to me, it's like the, and he killed it, by the way.
I think you're talking about H from the UK, the white kid. Yeah,
and he did, and he killed it. But I think beats are like clothes. You know, like the outfit I choose to wear, you might not be able to deny the stitching is fire or whatever, but this, I'm not wearing that. You know what I mean? This is, I'm wearing this. And because I wear this, this is how I get judged.
Yeah.
And so there's been days where I've gone to a funeral or a wedding and I wear a suit that day. And then I drive home and I stop at the coffee shop on the way. And the way I get treated is completely different than the way I get treated when I'm wearing this. And
really?
So, yeah, of course. So we're like humans, we're judgmental, and we look and we hear things, and that's how we form our opinions. So to me, the beats are like your outfit. You know what I mean? And I like wearing that, but they're wearing that over there. And I can't deny that that's not fire, but it's just not, I don't shop there.
Right.
And so like that kid right there on that shit, it's just not, it's not, the beat wasn't speaking my language. I gave it a moment because I'm in here with you. I'm listening to it in this environment.
Yeah.
And so it was dope. You know what I mean? But if I was in my room by myself, I don't know. You know what I mean? So,
but especially like with UK hip hop, that's part of what I find really exciting about it, is the fact that I really just don't have a frame of reference for most of it. Like, it's just so much rap shit. If you've been around the industry for a while and stuff, you start to be able to notice the patterns. You start to see what people are doing. It just feels very like easy. Sometimes it feels like everybody's just saying the same shit. And then the UK shit is kind of like, they're using different slang. They got weird ass beats that don't just automatically make sense to my ear. There's all kinds of weird flows that have developed based on reference points that I don't have.
Yeah, I like them because the accent, the way they speak English, they put accents on different parts of the words. So it allows different words to rhyme that would have never rhymed in an American English, which is a trip.
Right.
You know what I mean? So yeah, I can fuck with that.
Yeah, I like it too, because English people are just funny as fuck. Super sarcastic, super weird. They love slang.
You spend a lot of time out there?
Over the years, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
I was just listening to Talib talk about you guys staying in the hostel. That was a pretty great mental image.
So fire. I didn't want to tell him it wasn't a hostel. It was like a pre Airbnb. It was like, okay. But it looked like one. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
You've been smoking weed your whole life?
I've been smoking weed since like around when I hurt my arm.
Okay.
12, 13.
Yeah, because like for the record, people, and you should go listen to that Zilla podcast that you did. That was a good one. But it's kind of interesting because he's like, basically, he was so surprised that you guys cared enough about smoking weed that you would apparently stay in a different type of spot than where he was staying at. And to me, it was like, but I I'm picturing the mental image, and I'm picturing you and Alchemist on tour together, and I'm picturing you guys just wanting to be able to vibe. I mean, if you can't, like people don't realize that the levels of friction that you put between a weed smoker and them actually smoking weed has a huge amount to do with the comfortableness of the situation. Motherfucker, rappers do not like being in. So a lot of normal people think it's normal to be like, oh yeah, this is a recording studio, but you gotta go outside to smoke. That is not gonna work.
I was telling you earlier, I think I should quit weed just to become more of an asshole. You know what I mean? I'm saying
that's definitely what happens when I quit weed.
Yeah, man, I need to get upset to write a good rhyme, and I haven't been upset for a minute. So,
No, it definitely fucking. And I wonder that too. I was reading an interview with somebody, and they were like, "Yeah, you know, I spent a couple of years in a cloud smoking weed, and then one day I just decided that I wanted to get my life together." And I'm like, "Damn, do I not have my life together because I'm getting faded?"
I think I'm riding out, man. I think I'm riding out with the weed.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, because like there's levels to being a pothead. Like there's definitely people that we know who are just out here smoking fucking either a ridiculous amount of like a normal way to smoke, like blunts and spliffs and stuff. But then there's also people who are totally like out of their mind off the dabs, which to me is like you're taking an amount of THC that is so otherworldly in comparison to the way that most people smoke.
Yeah, like dabs is the next level of pot smoking. I don't dab. You dab?
Nah.
That's like a coca plant and doing cocaine versus like that's the weed version of coke to me.
Mm.
Yeah.
You never did cocaine?
I never did coke.
You never felt the need to go there?
I think I'm the only person in Los Angeles who never did cocaine.
That might be true.
Yeah, that's crazy. I just, my pops was into it. It was around me a lot. And I saw the negative effect of that shit way early to know I wasn't navigating in that direction.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. Like growing up in Venice, you're like exposed to a lot of stuff really early. And you feel like that was almost what made you want to sort of stay away from a lot of the negative things that you could have got into.
Yeah. Plus, like that era of rap was like the we don't do drugs. We might push them, but we're not doing drugs. Like, I don't know when drugs came into rap. You know, like all the rap shit I knew, it was like dudes was not doing drugs, not even smoking weed, really. That was like kind of like way out if you were doing that. That was like some Cypress Hill shit.
Dre dissed weed in like 91 or something.
It wasn't the normal thing. A lot of people were straight. People were drinking.
Yeah.
But yeah, weed wasn't like the thing. And doing coke or like meth or heroin or like you were a straight junkie. You know what I mean?
But it's interesting because there were a lot of rappers that, you know, somebody like Prodigy who had a lot of struggles with like real hardcore drugs and like, but it was pretty well shielded from the public. Like it never really became part of like, it's not like people were writing articles about it, even though if you were really paying attention to his lyrics, you probably could have felt some of that.
Yeah, but he had a real sickness that he was fighting. The pain that he was dealing with every day was more than any of us could imagine, you know, and that disease is crazy too. You know, and the P thing was crazy. If anything, he's excused, you know, but there was a lot of people now that were finding out that were on drugs that we were looking at as role models at the time, you know,
right,
which was crazy. But, you know.
It's weird to me that I was such an idiot that I didn't realize that 3 Six Mafia were rapping about coke all the time.
Crazy. Yo, salute to them, man. They really like pioneers of this whole shit, man.
Yeah.
Like the sound they put out like has shaped modern rap way early.
Wow, that was awkward.
You were pretty good on those. You might need to flip it to redeem yourself one time. Show everybody.
Damn, sitting down. I don't know if I can do it.
Fail blog.
Hashtag fail.
There used to be a fail blog where you would go and just see fails.
There you go. Fail Army. There was a lot of like YouTube channels that blew the fuck up off just the concept of posting fails.
Love it.
You have any interest in battle rap at this point in your life?
No, definitely not.
Doesn't do it for you?
No, I'm not trying to battle anybody.
Not you doing it, but just watching it and stuff.
Oh, crazy.
Appreciating it.
Yes, yeah. Battle rappers are the best. They're the best out, like the best rappers. They write more fire in for one battle that's going to be aired one time than rappers do for a whole album's worth of material for one battle. It's like the amount of pressure they go through, short notice, the pressure to always deliver and be consistent in that. You can't be a fluke. You have to like legit be good at the craft. So they're like the best battle rappers, even the worst one.
When I get a battle rapper in for an interview, it's kind of overwhelming because I know that there's like, you know, I'm going to have to watch at least maybe like 4 or 5 battles that are at least 45 minutes long, but it's so entertaining and it's so interesting to just sit there and stare and watch the crowd fluctuate. And like just that, the whole fact that it's judged just based on the personality, the cult of who believes in who on stage is just such a bizarre, like sort of almost like primitive type of thing in a sense, like where it's like this is like the most basic level of our understanding of how human beings establish a social order.
Confrontation in front of a crowd, it's nothing new, you know what I mean? And they're like the fucking gladiators of that shit, man. It's crazy. And I respect it more, even if they can take that, use that as a platform to spring them up to another level, which doesn't happen a lot, which is interesting, because writing bars is a different thing than songwriting.
Yeah, that is kind of something that a lot of rappers at various points in their life have to reckon with, have to deal with the fact that, oh, I can write a bunch of crazy ass punchlines, but nobody really wants to hear me rap in a situation outside of that.
It's a weird phenomenon.
Yeah, that's weird. So are you at the point in your life now where you're still sort of looking for young talent, for, you know, people who haven't been discovered yet? Is that something that you could imagine yourself doing in the sense of like actually signing an artist and pushing them?
100%, but I don't want to take that on until I'm ready to do it, but I'm moving close towards that. I promise I am. I remember about 2010 or nine or 10, maybe going into 11, there was a rapper named Fashon who was working with this dude, Exile. And my man Planet Asia said he's got to come through, and he came through. And I liked him so much, I introduced him to Alchemist. We took him to Europe. That was the story Kweli was talking about. Fash, he ended up getting a XXL cover, signed with Nas, et cetera. And that was the last time where I was like, okay. And I did that out of love and just wanting to show the world somebody I thought was dope. But I was like, in my mind, the next time I do that, I'm going to have an album I produce for them, or I'm going to have some kind of vested interest in them past just being their homie.
Right.
I still do it for the love, but I really want to be smart at the business side of that as well, and make it, if I'm going to introduce you and let you steal my fans and bring you around and do what you need to do, even if that's not the end of where you're going to go, hopefully you'll jump over that at some point. I want to be tied to it. And I think that's getting older and wanting to be smart on the business side.
There's a lot of heartbroken managers out there, you know, like managers who I've seen even just in my time doing interviews and stuff, where I'll see some really enthusiastic manager and then all of a sudden, you know, the artist dips off and is just doing something with somebody else, and they just seem so hurt. I guess it's completely different for you because you have the ability to actually like shape the music with the beats and everything.
No, I've gone through it, man. I've gone through it. When we were Dilated, we had all the big managers. We had whoever was the popping guy at the popping firm. We had those.
Right.
Then I went solo and I was like, if I'm going to go solo, I'm going to shed everything that I had, including lawyers and managers. I'm going to start from ground up. I'm not going to put of Dilated Peoples on anything I do. When I perform solo songs, perform shows, I'm only going to do solo songs. I'm not going to do any of my Dilated catalog. I'm going to start over. And that means I need to find a manager. So I found this guy who was chilling with Strong Arm Steady, making shirts for them and kicking it a lot, and coming to the studio. And Strong Arm Steady is like Crondon and Feel the Agony and Mitchie Slick. And, and he was this dude, Brock, and, you know, he was coming through and sleeping on my couch, and we were, like, building some shit up together, and something went wrong, and he really wasn't, like, the most responsible guy as far as, like, logistics of shit, and I got stuck somewhere in some airport in another country, and I came back, you're fired, you know, I don't want to work, and, you know, now Brock is doing Kendrick and doing everything big, you know, it's like,
oh, right.
He's A&R killing shit, you know, and it's funny, and that was, like, I'm proud of him, so proud of him. But it was funny to see somebody who was kind of like pissed off in our situation and take that and then shoot to the top of the planet in his world.
Yeah.
So yeah, like, and that hurt me for a minute. While I was creating my next stuff, I was thinking, fuck, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Or so even when an artist drops somebody and they're moving on, it looks like they're popping and the manager got left behind, a lot of the times the artist is still like in their feelings about that shit.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
See, that's interesting, yeah, because like I've had a lot of different opportunities over the past couple of years where artists have said like, "Oh, I want you to manage me" or some shit, and it's like I just have never been able to really imagine myself biting off that, because it's like I feel like if you're gonna do it the right way, you have to be willing to like treat their career as something you care about as much as you care about your own career.
100.
And I can't get there right now.
Good management should, as a manager and an artist, should never have a contract. No contract. Mm. It should just be a mutual thing. And that usually leaves the artist with a lot more outs, and the manager gets fucked in that situation. But if it's really working out and the manager's really doing their job and really doing their job, because sometimes the artist feels like they're working for the manager. Mm. It's not the case. Then there should be no reason to go anywhere. Everything should be good.
Yeah, because it's like a relationship, right? Where it's like you would never want to have a contract with the person that you're seeing, because, you know, if you want to go, you should go.
Straight up. Yeah. So it's a risky business on the manager side, but definitely it should be a mutual thing, straight up.
Yeah. So do you have anyone managing you at this point? Do you feel like that's
No, I do. I have a good manager, yeah. Okay. Kevin Zinger, he's dope. And he's filled in the blanks and gone beyond his duties, you know, for me to, I'm in a good place with him.
Yeah.
He's one up.
Do you feel like he understands? Yeah, it's like, is there something that it takes to understand where you're at in your career and what you're trying to do that's different than a lot of the artists that managers are flocking to?
I'm not trying to. After Brock, I really learned a lesson. And my mom used to do it. My mom was a photographer. She used to like hire people. And I think she was probably lonely in that time of her life a little bit. So she would befriend a lot of her employees, and she would try to go eat lunch with them and stuff when they probably wanted to get the fuck away. And they ended up leaving, you know what I mean? Because at some point they felt like this is too much, you know? And so I learned that lesson with Brock. After that, I was like, I'm never going to be a friend with my manager. I'm not going to be a friend. We're going to have a good working relationship, and I'm going to keep it at that. And I've done a good job with Kevin. Although he really did become my friend and he's the fucking man. I don't feel like that attachment as a friend that is there. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean it in the best way possible, as far as my emotions are not tied up in our business relationship.
Well, have you had to go through that where in the early stages of your career, you're hiring a lot of your friends, people who are working for you are just your friends. And then it feels like over time, that is sort of like an inevitable thing that you sort of have to shed, because the truth is that the best person for the job is usually not the person that you were hanging out with before you were doing your thing.
If you get lucky, it happens. But time and time again, it's not the case. You know what I'm saying? But there's something to be said for that motherfucker, though, because you're learning a lot, and somebody learning with you is like, there's something special about that when you just go to somebody and claim they know it all. And like I said, at some point you feel like you're working for them. There's something to be said about building something up with somebody you came up with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you feel when you see this top 100 rappers conversation going on? What would your list look like, and how different would it be from a lot of the ones that we're seeing?
I don't think it's possible for any one person to make a list.
I think it's 50, actually, just to correct myself. 50. Yeah.
But I would have to know the person's motive behind the list. Mm. Like, what are we judging this shit on? Because I talked to somebody who I respect, and I'll leave him out, but we were talking about the greatest rappers a long time ago in a studio session. And his era's greats, Jay-Z, Big, Nas, etc. And I said, what about this guy, though? And this guy is somebody who's like a real lyricist. And he was like, yeah, he's good, but he didn't change a fucking era, though. You know what I mean? Or he didn't, you know, like, to him, the greatest are people who have like changed the game. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or had defining moments or hit records. You know what I mean? So for that list, we could make more. Then we can make like the best technical rappers.
Right.
But, you know, like, it's just absolutely impossible. I think people have different goals in this game. Some people want to be the best lyricist. Some people want to have the most people at their shows. Some people want to make hit records. You know what I mean? So it just depends on what your real goal is. And I think those lists would reflect accordingly. The one that I saw was like, there was a lot that should be on there to me. I just think that was also a generational thing. So to these new rappers looking at that, it might look a little crazy in the same way that the rappers who came before my era probably wouldn't be in that list as well.
You know, it's interesting. This whole list thing blew up because of the fucking fact that somebody included Joe Budden on their list. And I guess that kind of
Joe Budden didn't make that list.
No. It was some random podcast with like 400 fucking followers who put this list out here, which is one of the funniest things I think about it.
He made that list and put himself third.
No, But you know, that's the funny thing is that Joe Budden never shifted the culture. He never changed anything sonically or whatever. He's just a very good technical proficient rapper.
But is just a very good rapper. Like, that's what I'm saying.
Exactly.
See, this, like, is my point. Yeah. And so it's like, there's drummers, you go link up in the drummer fucking world of people, and there's drummers who talk, and some could, it's like drum roll contests, you know what I'm saying? But when you come time to play a song,
right,
there's maybe one little section for you to do that, but you gotta make something that's gonna translate and that put a steady beat out.
Yeah.
And so then you're not focusing on so much on the rolls, but can I play this drum beat at the same exact time mark every time? Or, you know, how steady can I keep it for the rapper or the singer? And you focus on nuances that other people might not recognize your greatness. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And that's the same thing with slow flowing. Like we were talking about with, like, you know, with slow flow rapping is like way exposed. That's the exact same thing as a drummer, just being able to keep perfect time, you know, and there might not be a lot of extra tricks, but you can't deny the skill set and what he's doing right there. So, yeah. I got off. Where were we going? Oh, so yeah. So the,
Joe Budden.
Just being a fucking good rapper not make you eligible to be top 50 of all time.
But it's a very
time.
Different list. And also the thing that pisses me off about it, though, is that it's like, okay, if I was going to make that list, I'm going to put Cameron way higher than the average person puts Cameron. I'm going to put 50 Cent way higher than the average person puts 50 Cent, because that was like, for me when I was 18, that was like my whole life.
See, but I don't want to knock them because those are slow flowers, right? Or they're not as lyrical and there's not as many things that line up in between. There's in with they don't rhyme within the bars. They might rhyme at the end of the bars, you know? But it's, to me, Get Rich or Die Trying is one of the most powerful albums of all time. Like, my mom felt that shit.
And
you know what
I'm
saying?
It's no
like,
lyrical masterpiece. It's
no,
just
it is.
Powerful.
No,
right. But no, not in a technical sense. Yeah.
Even in a technical, it's just not overly complex.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But that's what I'm trying to say is like getting your point across and saying it simply is one of the greatest things. Hence the reason you like Cameron and 50 Cent. That shit moved you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even if it wasn't as wordy.
And the only list, though, that I'm interested in reading is the kind of list where somebody feels comfortable putting Joe Budden at number three and being like, yo, Joe Budden is my third favorite rapper of all time. I'm interested in that. I don't want to hear a fucking a quantified thing where it's like, this guy was this important, so he belongs there. Everybody's just roasting each other for these lists.
My question to you is somebody who's kind of, safe to say, has the pulse of what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from Snoop Dogg, like you were saying, being influenced by, where, at what point do you move the greats out and bring the new in to the same list?
It's very hard.
Do they belong together, or is rap something different now?
Yeah. Well, when you see those lists, I feel like you're seeing like the same sort of, in terms of the modern rappers, you see Drake, you see Kendrick, you see J. Cole.
Those three.
Yeah, those are the ones that you inevitably see every time. And even like, you know, Eminem's a current rapper. He's not, we don't think of him as being in the prime of his career, despite the fact he's still probably just as popular as he ever was.
No, he's killing it on a longevity level. The fact that he's this relevant is a testament to what he did and the hunger to keep going. I'm saying age-wise, young, new style of rap when the beat switched.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, you know, that's the crazy thing too, though, is if it's, I don't think you've seen anybody put Chief Keef and Young Thug on those lists, but to me, Chief Keef and Young Thug are probably some of the most, they changed the culture. They changed rap the
so
most in the past 10 years.
If we made a 50 list on the people who shifted culture, then that would make more sense.
Yeah.
And then we could do a lyrical list, and then we could do another list of some sort.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just a weird conversation to have because I was trying to picture myself making a list and just picturing myself getting roasted no matter what the fuck I put on there, because anything that veered from the status quo at all is just going to get destroyed on Twitter. It's such a toxic atmosphere.
Not if it had a prerequisite above it saying
this is what I'm into.
This, or this is the reason, this is the lyrical list or this is the hit record list.
Yeah. But do you have a relationship with Twitter?
I do. I love Twitter.
Okay.
You want Twitter? No.
No, hugely. But I just feel like Twitter is one thing that a lot of people like. You seem like you're at a pretty good state mentally, matured, like kind of realizing that there's certain frivolous things that you shouldn't be putting your attention into. And it feels like Twitter is one thing that people at some point realize like, oh, this isn't healthy for me.
Who you are on Twitter and who you are on Instagram are two completely fucking different people.
Oh yeah.
You know, sometimes you'll find someone talking wild shit and then you'll just search the name on Instagram and it's like them with puppies and shit. You know what I mean? It's like, it's, you, it, it, person, you just, this is to like say shit you can't always say, and this is to like try to be who you want to be, like put out that image. The Twitter is good for me. I'll share my life on Instagram and be like personal and be like, you know what I'm saying, post pictures of my son in the hopes that one day he'll see the messages I'm writing to him here. And on Twitter, I will never post a picture of my kid. I feel like that's up for scrutiny. That's up for wild shit, depending on my, if I'm, who I'm voting for. You know what I mean? Like that's a wild place.
No, it's almost like inevitably anything that you put on, like Twitter is for everyone else. Whereas like, if you are not a fan of me, you really have almost no reason to run into my Instagram, you know, or unless you're interested in going there. Whereas like Twitter, I mean, Twitter is the place where we know that someone will post something of something that they're into, and then somebody will quote tweet it and get 10,000, 100,000 retweets. It happens every day over and over and over, where it's just somebody who likes one thing and then somebody who doesn't like that thing.
Twitter is the
place.
Twitter
put them on blast. Yeah, ruin their fucking life for a while.
Twitter is the place that you can't beat the internet. That's the spot. You know what I mean? Instagram is more of a safe haven for, for shit.
And then you have like Facebook, where it's like, I would never dream of reading a Facebook comment in a million years, no matter.
I haven't logged into that shit in years, bro.
Once in a while, it'll pop up in my Google alerts of like, oh, there's this thread on Facebook of like a bunch of people talking about you. And I'm like, no, should have done it on Twitter.
Yeah, that's just for the birds.
That'd be like going to Walmart and just hanging out and listening and see if anybody was talking about you.
You go to Walmart?
That's what fucking being on Facebook is Walmart.
It is Walmart of the internet.
And that's why Twitter's dope, because it's like Spencer's. Like Hot Topic.
I don't even know what Spencer's or Hot Topic.
It's where you buy like fart pills and shit. Like an ICP shirt.
I like that.
You know Hot Topic, right?
No.
Really? You ain't been in the mall in that long?
No.
Damn, man. You're an adult.
I'm an adult.
I got arrested for shoplifting from Hot Topic when I was 13.
Fuck.
Terrible. Candles or some shit. Like a chain wallet.
Too much info.
So let's talk about, I wanted to ask this before we even talk about like what you have on the way is, will there ever be another Dilated project? Could you imagine yourself getting into that state of mind?
I don't think so right now. I won't rule it out. That's always like it's not necessary. I think groups get emotional and they're never doing another thing. I don't know what the future will.
Do they put any kind of pressure on you? Like, yo, we should do some shit.
I think a little bit sometimes here and there, and maybe I've,
you've been that guy at times?
I've probably been that guy. And I've also, if it made sense, I've also done it. You know what I'm saying? There's still shows. Europe is still good to us. There's still places people come with a bag and a genuine interest in doing something. I think we're still a draw. You know, I think we could.
You guys do that Euro festival type shit?
We do. Historically, we have. We have not in a long time. I think we were running ourselves thin doing that shit.
Because if you don't do it for a long time, then it's like, oh, they're going to lay a headline. A weird thing.
And that's what I'm saying, you want to come back as that nostalgic thing. I don't know if I want to do that right now. I'm still pushing, still striving to do shit. And I feel like Dilated is something we did and did well, and that's that. With that said, Rock and Babu are my brothers, and going away from them for a minute does make you realize, when someone's in your life and shaped you so much, how much you do miss them sometimes. So I think I missed them, but I'm not going to get that confused with needing to do a new record right now.
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah, but evidence thing is what's pushing me right now.
Right. Yeah. So your new project you've been working on, when do you see that kind of coming to fruition? When do you think you're going to start rapping over those beats you've been making?
Making a lot of beats. That's been my hobby lately. Just beats is what I'm really into right now more than anything. Throughout my career, I've been blessed to have the best, like Alchemist and Premier and Knots and you name it. I've worked with them, and something feels safe about that to me right now, where I don't want to do that again. And that means that I'm challenging myself, because who wouldn't want to do that? But for me, as a beat maker and somebody who's putting a lot of my heart into it and having people take my beats, I've been working with West Side Gunn, and I did a Damo project from Odd Future. I did Defara album, a Mad Child album. I got a new album with someone coming on the way. I feel like I respect them and they fuck with my shit. It's time that I step up and do my own album, which means it could be my worst or my best record. I feel like it's not going to leave much in the middle, and that's where I need to be. So sometimes I write a rhyme to my beat and I think it's the shit and I'm ready to go, and then Al plays me a beat and I chicken out, and the rap I had written to that, I'll spit it to his shit.
And really?
Historically, I've done that. So this time I just need to like at least shape the sound of the album myself. And then I can possibly venture out and show people, this is what I'm going for. Do you have something that can add on to that? Instead of letting them shape the sound of the album. And those are my favorites. Those are the best to me, you know, but it feels like something I need to do. All four of my albums have been weather related. I'm the weatherman. That's my moniker, you know? And so my first one was Weatherman. Second one was Layover. Third, Cats and Dogs. Fourth, Weather or Not. And I feel like I need to put an end to that chapter and do something new. So I actually got the name for my next album. It was given to me today by Laura while we were waiting.
What was it again?
Tough Crowd.
Tough Crowd.
She said I'm a tough crowd because she was trying to get shit out of me and I wasn't giving her any info.
So what, she was trying to pry you open before the interview even started? She didn't tell me about anything she learned?
Yeah, it was too much.
Really?
Laura with all the questions. But Tough Crowd, I think that's my album.
I like that. Because, I mean, it's an apt metaphor.
It's good.
It is a fucking tough crowd out there.
And I'm a tough crowd, apparently.
Well, you're a tough crowd in the sense that you're a traditionalist in a lot of ways, that it's like you're not somebody who's necessarily 100% receptive to a lot of stuff that people are trying to sell you on.
I'm more open than you would think when it comes to music, if that's what you're getting at.
Oh, no. But, I mean, in your personal style, it feels like you sort of, you know, there's not that many people who are like feel like they're really holding true to the classic roots of hip hop, and the ones that do get a lot of praise for it.
I don't
in
make
certain senses.
I don't make music with that in my mind. I'm not doing that. I promise. It's just what I fucking love to do. When I came up, we loved Gangstar, we loved DPMD, we loved certain shit, and that's what we modeled our shit after. Uh-huh. Was people we aspired to be like. If I genuinely was into pop shit or big shit or what was getting you the bitches and the money immediately, I probably would have been a different artist. So I think it's just it's for better or for worse. It's just who I am.
Yeah.
And there's a big renaissance of that right now. And not people like doing throwback shit, but really like a bunch of like-minded people. And I'm finding they're pushing the culture forward in a lot of ways, whether it's being pushed by labels or not. There's like a new section of whether it's YouTube or wherever the fuck you find it, or a live show, of a lot of people who are doing gutter shit right now that's not built for the radio. And getting big followings and having success with it, even if it's not on a major, major level.
Right.
Yeah.
You're very, still like very sample oriented, whereas the rest of hip hop is no longer there.
A lot of pop records are sampled now.
Right.
You'd be surprised. There's a lot of people sampled.
But there's like been this whole sort of rejection of that in a lot of hip hop music, and primarily just for money reasons, right?
Yeah, that was the main thing that deterred you originally, was just sampling some shit and getting denied or having to pay. Give up all your publishing.
Right.
New cats coming out are like, I am not giving up on my fucking publishing.
Do you try not to think about that when you're making a song?
Yeah, but I'm still underground enough where a lot of that stuff doesn't come to the surface, God willing. You know what I mean? I'm not all the way.
Oh, so there's an art to sort of hiding that shit? Yeah.
Depends who you ask. If you're on a big enough channel, I think you should. If you're flying below the radar, I don't know if it's all the way necessary. If it starts to pop and you see indicators of that shit shooting up, do it.
See, I heard that the labels have bounties out on finding samples that
they do
are unidentified. Yeah, that's scary.
It's so scary. But that's the thing, is like there's even people who are popping, making big records. They get a sample pack from somebody, right? So they're not sampling a record per se, but they're doing sample packs where somebody made a bunch of music with the intention of being sampled. And in those packs, a lot of people put a from James Brown, or they do a little things, you know. A lot of people putting samples in their shit, not even realizing it.
Right.
You know, so.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Damn. That's crazy. All right. So, yeah, man, it was dope getting a chance to talk to you, man.
Thank you for this opportunity.
I appreciate you coming in for sure. I would love to like link up, see the creative process at some point, or like get in the studio with you and Alchemist or something. I'll pull up with a fucking pound of weed and we can figure something out, right?
Let's go, man. Yeah, let's go.
That'd be sick. Appreciate you, man. Evidence, No Jumper, coolest podcast in the world. Check us out on YouTube, SoundCloud, iTunes. Like, comment, and subscribe. NoJumper.com if you want to support. Appreciate you, man.